Well, this is a very big and difficult problem. At the risk of annoying many of my own friends in the service, I must say that in the circumstances of the Korean campaign, I am not surprised, not at all surprised, that the air has imposed only relatively small delay. Conditions in Europe with big targets and vital centers to attack are quite beside the question. Remember also that we are restricted in our major air operations in that area by political requirements. Further, if you're attacking people building wooden bridges across rivers, it is a very difficult problem to put those bridges out of action. If they are ferrying tanks over in boats, it is very difficult to put those boats out of action.
Even more difficult than to attack the bridges.
Even more difficult than to attack the bridges. And so I think that those people who hoped very much from a delaying action from the air in North Korea forgot the lessons of the 1914-18 war, of the 1939-45 war, of air operations in similar conditions, and in particular, they forgot the climatic and geographic conditions that exist in Korea today.
Yes, but while agreeing with that, let's apply that lesson to, say, the situation which might develop in Western Europe.
Well, no war is ever fought like the last war. And quite obviously, the conditions in Europe will vary very materially from those in Korea. What we want to learn from this is that we must be sure that we've got the right aircraft to do the job. We must be sure that we've got the right weapons to do the job and the right tactics. And each task will vary from another. And each must be studied in relation to the circumstances of the case. We cannot expect effective delaying action in the conditions which exist in Korea. We might expect a better result from European conditions.
Well, that's a more optimistic view of it, but I think it's fair to say that only a few months ago there were many people, both here and in the United States, who were thinking in terms of the Western powers being able to impose, through tactical air power, sufficient delay on any Russian columns which may attempt to come, for instance, west of the Elbe. Now, I would feel, I don't know what you think, Wells, that the Korean experience suggests that we should revise their optimism.
I think that's very true. I think that the United States has tended, perhaps in the last year or two, to think too much in terms of long-range strategic bombing, which would attack the heartland of the enemy, but which at the same time could do very little to stop what you might call the enemy hordes overrunning the vital civilization and the industrial centers of Western Europe.
Yes.
I think we've seen in North and South Korea that we have to revert to military fundamentals, that we cannot have an unbalanced air force, we cannot have an unbalanced fighting machine. The Queen, the infantry, is not dead, as many people have thought.
And in the case of the Korean situation, there was no opportunity, as I see it, of applying strategic air power.
Not at all.
There were no centers of production or of industry which could be directly attacked and destroyed. It was essentially a matter of using tactical air power, which we couldn't apply effectively. Now, Devine, what do you think about it? Do you think we could apply tactical air power effectively in Europe?
I don't think so to any very much greater extent than in Korea. I still believe that ground force has to be opposed by ground force. It's all very well if you contract your enemy, if you can get him
in a defile,
if you can get him canalized, if you can get what we got after the Normandy breakout, the Calais Gap, isn't it? You can bring maximum power to bear on a limited area, and you can eliminate ground forces. But you cannot do it over broad fronts.
Particularly in Western Europe, when you have so many channels of approach. I mean, the number of good roads and not even the number of roads that count, because over most of Western Europe, armor and tracked vehicles can move at will.
Absolutely at will. You see, I don't think that with all the reports that have appeared somewhat unfortunately in some papers, of American retreats and so on in this, I don't think that the Americans have put up at all a bad show, considering everything.
Nor have the South Koreans.
Since the first rush, the movement south of the North Korean forces has been limited to something under 6 miles a day, and that's a pretty considerable achievement in view of the terrain, in view of the fact that the enemy was operating on interior lines with the choice of time, the choice of build-up, and the inevitable power of the aggressor.
And about 15 divisions.
Well, I wouldn't agree with 15 divisions, but I personally think that the North Korean forces don't number more than the equivalent of, say, 6 or 7 American divisions.
15 divisions of 9,000 men each, yes. More or less what has been identified, I believe, so far.
Well, we'll leave that argument, but I think you're right, Devine, in view of the fact that there were no tanks and few anti-tank weapons available in the South, the delay imposed on the North has been very considerable.
But I
still feel that one of the major lessons that we've got to learn is that we must revise our military estimate of the military capacity of the satellite countries. We can't write them off merely as puppets.
That's extremely true. I think we have tended to underrate the possibilities of the satellite countries all the way through. North Korea, been really something of a joke in as far as people in the Far East have been concerned. Nobody has ever imagined that the North Korean army would amount to a very decisive factor in any campaign.
No.
But it has turned out, sir.
Of course, there is one factor which is peculiarly in favor of the North Korean forces, and that is that there were so many Koreans who have been living in Russia for the last 20 or 30 years, many of whom have served in the Russian, in the Red Army during the war, and who have been trained by the Russians to take over not only military posts, but administrative posts in North Korea. So that you really had good Soviet communists.
Yes, and you've had 65,000 Koreans who've been fighting with the Chinese communist armies in Manchuria ever since 1931 against the Japanese occupation.
Yes.
And they've had excellent guerrilla training.
So that, from that point of view, the situation of strength was quite unquestionably in favor of the North Koreans. And the next point, which we may learn, I think, from the situation in Korea, is that this kind of thing might happen at many points around the Soviet perimeter. It might happen, for instance, in Burma. It might happen in Persia. It might happen in Yugoslavia. And I think, well, you'll agree that over recent months, we've been thinking rather in terms of building up what Atchison calls situations of strength in the economic sense,
yes,
rather than in the military sense.
Yes. I think the time has come, and I think the time is now at hand, actually, when the Western world must put defense once more ahead of economic recovery. Economic recovery in Western Europe, for instance, has come along so fast in the last 3 or 4 years that in many respects, production levels are well above pre-war.
Yes.
I think the time has come now when we have to realize that we have facing us a very grave situation. There are no sidelines, as Anthony Eden said the other day. We're not standing off to one side in the world as it is constituted. We are either fighting for our liberties and our lives and protection of peace, or else we're going under. And we cannot fight and win if we're going to try to have more wigs and more teeth, and in the United States we have just as much as we have here, before we have wings and armor and anti-tank guns that can go through tanks.
Well, the speech made by President Truman yesterday and his message to Congress clearly points to the fact that the United States is to have a very much higher degree of mobilization, a very much greater, a fantastically greater expenditure on defense than she has had even in recent years. And now, Joubert, what do you think about our reaction in this crisis?
Well, I think Mr. Attlee's speech in the House certainly gave all of us who are concerned with the condition of our armed forces a great deal of hope. I think many of us feel that we have, for reasons which seemed at the time excellent, let our state of preparedness and of defense particularly in regard to weapons and to trained personnel, to run below the safety limit. I must and will continue to hope that the situation with which we are faced will be dealt with by the government of the day in the manner which it needs.
One of the disturbing factors about our military situation, speaking entirely for this country, for Britain, is that whereas we have about 500,000 men in the army alone, we have at the moment only five or six divisions which could be put in the field. And it seems to me that we've got to toughen our armed forces up a very great deal. We have far too big a tail. We have far too many welfare units and far too many services behind the lines and not nearly enough chaps who are in a position to go into the field and to serve in operational units. What do you think, Brian?
I think that's very much the case, and distressingly so. And I think that we ought to take a lesson from South Korea on this, because I believe that the delays that have been imposed on the North Korean advance have been imposed almost entirely by small infantry units operating from foxholes, trenches, call it anything else you like, operating with infantry-borne weapons and holding up masses of opposing infantry.
The chaps with the bayonets and the bazookas.
Exactly, and that is what we must have. It's no good, these easy solutions to the problem of warfare, and I do regard this concentration on strategic bombing and things of that sort as one of the easy solutions. We still must have ground armies. We have not got anywhere past that stage yet.
I think one of the interesting factors in that is the lesson that we've learned in the United States. We've been going through an economy program for the last two or three years and trying to cut our defense expenditure to the bone. There have been political implications to it. But one of the lessons we've learned is that the United States Marine Corps, which through tradition has been the fighting service of the American armed forces, has been cut far, far too small. We've had the 1st Marine Division cut to one regiment, and now we're building it up again. And I think if we've learned one lesson from the Korean operations, it is that we must keep a trained ground force ready for instant action anywhere in the world and ready with air transport and air power to back it up.
Now, turning from the mobilization side and the improvement of our preparedness in terms of manpower, it seems to me that the next thing that we have to look to is the question of our weapons. Now, we've got some rude shocks in the Korean fighting. We found that the North Koreans are using Russian tanks to which we have had no answer. And I think we might well perhaps sum up this discussion and turning to the research side, to the question of the efficiency of our weapons. And, well, what would you think, taking from the Army point of view, the key question is?
I think the key question to my mind is this. Have we got an anti-tank weapon? Have we got a tank that can stand up anything against anything that the communist world can throw against us?
And Devine?
I still think that despite the fact that there's been no aggressive naval action against us, that our principal question is, have we got something that can stand against the submarine?
Particularly the submarine developed from those fast German underwater types.
Particularly the submarine from the fast type.
Well, I would very much like to know, what is the solution to the enemy-guided missile?
Well, now, there you have three questions which our research experts might well consider. Questions that do arise out of the Korean fighting, and questions that I believe, and I think we all believe, the West must be able to answer, and must be able to answer very soon.
You've been listening to a discussion in the weekly series London Forum, recorded in a studio of the BBC. The speakers were Arthur Devine, Sir Philip Joubert, and Benjamin Wells, with Chester Wilmot in the chair. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.